Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Solitude can be liberating, maddening, joyful, lonely. It also might feel very different today than it did several months ago. So Modern Love, the column and the podcast, is releasing a special project called Alone in a Pandemic. It features stories from people who live alone, telling us how they are doing right now. Today, we're sharing some of those stories recorded by the people who wrote them.
Hey, my name is Phyllis Coletta. I'm from Philly, now living in Seattle. And as a 63-year-old single woman, I am actually the operational definition of invisible. And actually, it's pretty liberating, not a big deal. I've been living with and serving other people for like 57 of my 63 years on Earth. So flying solo, pure bliss. For Christ's sake, you know, we're not pitiful misfits. Frankly, I'm actually the envy of plenty of friends, like women who can't talk to me on the phone when their husbands are in the same room. I do whatever I want, whenever I want, and lockdown changes that only about an inch. So as a teacher, I spend a few hours a day performing virtual root canal, trying to get my kids to engage with a computer, but in the intervening hours, I do all kinds of cool things. I run or walk 4 or 5 miles a day, do exercise classes, meditate, write. Our greedy, faux, busy, hustling, noisy consumer insanity has come to a screeching halt. And despite the suffering, there is so much beauty in the world right now. And in my little space in silence, there's nothing I want or need.
2 minutes into a FaceTime call with me, my 3-year-old niece, Lila, asked my sister, "Can we watch a different show now?" 6 weeks into sheltering at home alone, I'm trying my best not to be boring. When Lila and I FaceTime without my sister, she sometimes announces that she's going to another room. Even though she promises to come back for me soon, I feel a rush of panic, as if I physically live inside the phone. With no legs to follow her, I'm trapped wherever she leaves me. One time, she left me inside a plastic pumpkin. "Wait," I shouted, my field of vision narrowed by orange walls. I wonder if Lila's starting to conflate the human version of me with the pixelated one. The last time I saw her in real life, hugged her, held her tiny, precious, dirty little hands, was 4 months ago, i.e. 750 years in toddler time. I wonder if I'm also beginning to conflate the human version of me with the pixelated one. How long can people go without in-person human contact before they start to question the reality of their own existence?
I'm Amy Dempsey, and I'm in Portland, Maine.
I miss sex. Let's just put that right out there. Let's put it all out there. I'm an early 40s, overweight, gay, opera-singing, technical writer who went prematurely silver. It isn't like dozens of sex partners were lining up outside my door, but I had some friends, and we had benefits, and everyone was happy. No one was eager for anything to change. As someone who came out in the mid-90s, I was taught to be terrified of sex, learned that it could kill me as it had so many other LGBTQ people. The recent advent of pre-exposure prophylaxis, PrEP, meant that sex no longer equaled death, and for a few years, life was great. Enter the new coronavirus. And once again, sex equals death. My quarantine bubble does not include any of my friends with benefits. We don't have that level of relationship. We've sent some eggplant emojis to say we're alive, but none of us is risking death to connect in person. As the coronavirus timeline extends, I'm now wondering if I'll ever have sex again. I stopped taking PrEP last week. I used the money to buy a caftan and a turban. If I'm going to be a recluse, I may as well look the part. Shelby Condre, San Diego, California.
My goal in 2018 was to tell my dad I love you. It might not seem like a big deal, but to those who have immigrant parents, Asian parents, any type of, we provide for you, so why do we need to say it, parents, it's a big deal. It has been a long journey for me towards forgiveness and compassion for my dad. And as I neared 40, I needed to heal childhood wounds and change the narrative of our relationship. I hadn't been able to reach the goal, but was content enough with my intention. Then recently, isolated by this pandemic, seeing my dad on the video screen and not knowing when I would visit my parents again, I felt my heart soften. His face, grainy and backlit, stirred something within me. As he handed back the iPad to my mom, I said, "Love you," to the gap between their hands. I didn't know if he heard me. Last week, I said it again, "I love you, Ba." He was already turning away from the screen, but he paused, his body and voice still. He said, "Goodbye," again, somewhat gruffly, perhaps an acknowledgement, but it doesn't really matter. I did it. I don't think I will say it every time I talk to my dad, and I know it's not a complete turning point in our relationship, yet how miraculous, in this small but significant way, to feel years of burden fall away, to feel love stirring within, like grace. Chati Chu, Brooklyn, New York.
I'm CJ Jones, and I live in San Francisco.
A pandemic is a conundrum for someone like me, a person who has struggled with bipolar depression for the last 22 years. Because what keeps the body healthy in a pandemic, social distancing, festers sickness in the soul. Behavioral therapy for depression goes something like this. Go outside, visit family, hug a friend, take a group exercise class, smile at a stranger. And whatever you do, definitely don't stay alone in your pajamas all day, eating rice pudding in bed, and reading articles about an unpredictable, deadly disease. The days have been difficult, to say the least. I cried when the isolation began to affect even my dog, who pawed at my leg in unhappiness, not understanding why our two-hour walks had shrunk into 30 minutes in order to avoid the heavy city crowds, why we couldn't sit in our usual outdoor cafe simply to watch people and soak up the sun. But then I remember that everything eventually will pass. That's something they teach in behavioral therapy too.
Hey, my name is Claire Manship. I'm 28 years old, and I live in Hamilton Heights, Harlem. A couple of weeks ago, both of my roommates left town, and I was all alone in our three-bedroom apartment in Harlem. And I was getting really lonely. I read that there were a few local radio stations that were going to play songs for citywide sing-alongs after the citywide clap, starting with Frank Sinatra's New York, New York. Most people had been participating in the citywide clap in our neighborhood, but I seriously doubted that anyone would be doing a sing-along. And I was right. No one really did. But I wanted to sing anyway. I leaned out my window and started singing, "Start spreading the news." My voice was ringing down the alley, echoing back to me. And so then I finished the song loud and proud. And when I was done, all of my neighbors started cheering for me. And then after that, I sang for my neighbors every night for the last 3 weeks. I was spending so many days thinking I was alone. It didn't even occur to me that there were hundreds of other people feeling the same exact way, just a few feet away.
Stay with us. There are more of your stories after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building, find an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we're featuring stories submitted to Modern Love about what it feels like to live alone right now.
My name is Camila Aisha Moon, and I live in Decatur, Georgia. During this pandemic, I'm finding out so much about myself. Without realizing it, I've made it a point to always stay on the go, keeping the calendar as full as possible. I didn't see this as running, as resistance to fully settling into myself or my home until now. Spending afternoons in my backyard with the birds, squirrels, and the occasional rabbit has brought me so much solace. All of these tall, elegant trees, dappled sunlight. A silver lining has been slowing down enough to enjoy what I have. A different, more crucial kind of accounting. Time in nature as well.
Derek Chevelle, Greenwich Village. The texts started arriving a few weeks into quarantine, and I noticed that they were almost all identical. You know, things like, we're worried about you. Are you sure you're okay? You're alone. This must be so grueling for you. And they all came from my friends with kids, all wearing their condescension so proudly, as if sharing a home with several people of wildly differing heights gave them some sort of moral authority. They were worried about me. Yes, I'm alone. But they're trapped inside with feral children and partners that they're not going to be able to escape for weeks, maybe months, possibly years. I admit, like, some quarantine-induced paranoia might have played a part in my reaction, but the messages, the subtext, it was undeniable. Beyond some sincere concern, there was something going on here. It wasn't just about me or my current situation. It honestly felt like a bit of an attack on my life choices. Look, none of this is easy. FaceTime and Zoom calls only do so much. And as far as dating goes, the sexting and erotic pics haven't materialized, despite pretty much every article I've seen making it look as if that's all anyone living alone at home was doing. But I take comfort in the fact that I can take a nap whenever I want. I can focus on my work uninterrupted. I mean, I can steal time during the day to read. I can go for walks or runs without having to check in with anyone to see if that's okay. Answer me this. If it's so great with your family, why are you drinking whiskey at noon?
introvert that I am, I was made for this. I had an employer who continued to pay me as I worked from home. I had Wi-Fi. I have no children. A friend shared his Netflix password with me. I was hashtag blessed. Anxiety soon descended. When it finally dissipated, I realized that it wasn't actually anxiety, but sadness, fear, and frustration. I had just ended a relationship. I thought of all the couples having the quarantine sex that I could have been having. Oh, to be able to squeeze in a quickie between work Zoom meetings. My ex reached out during this time to, quote, check on me. I downloaded Bumble for the fourth time. There is a sense that this quarantine will further cement my singleness. Future social distancing makes making meaningful connections feel almost impossible. We've been encouraged to designate one person to do grocery shopping for the household, and yet I see so many masked-faced couples holding latex-gloved hands, gazing at cantaloupe together. I hate them. I wish I could be them. Simone Samuels, Toronto, Ontario.
My name is Desiree Ontiveros, and I live in New Orleans, Louisiana. It's impossible to be lonely in New Orleans. Try going on a quiet walk, perching solo on a bar stool, or standing in a grocery line. Someone will talk to you, and not just about the weather. Within minutes, you'll find you have a dozen acquaintances in common. Or at least that was my New Orleans. Today marks more than 2 months that I've scarcely left my one-bedroom townhome in the French Quarter. I took a couple of walks, and I attempted to go grocery shopping. Once. At the grocery, I kept my eyes down. Staring at the basket, I realized I didn't need the coffee. I didn't need the kale. And who touched these avocados? Those were luxuries of the past. I had plenty of canned food in my pantry that I had never touched, because who needs canned goods when you live in the French Quarter? I started to feel ill. Then I learned I had COVID-19. Was it the avocados? Living alone started to take its toll. Yes, my friends sent gift cards. Neighbors dropped food at my stoop. But who would know if I took a bad turn? If I couldn't breathe? My doctor FaceTimed me every day and took my chart home every night just in case I called. She was worried about me living alone. I really need to shop again now, but I'm sure some stranger will ask, "How you doing, baby?" And I'll be tempted to share everything. Unload all of my fears and insecurities, but it's not the same when you have to shout it from 6 feet away.
My name is Bette Ferber. Is there anything better in the world than holding hands? That sweet, simple gesture tells the whole story. My husband Mel and I held hands on our first date. Mel's been gone almost 17 years now, and I think of him every time I go for a walk, and every time one of our kids or grandkids reaches for my hand. This winter, after I turned 90, coronavirus arrived, and with it a certain anxiety. No visitors, no shared meals, no hugs or kisses, and hardest for me, no one to hold my hand. Sometimes I want to shout, "Why? What did I do?" Other times I just feel grateful for the safety of my apartment and calls from family and friends. I even learned to Zoom. I do wait for the day when this quarantine is over and I can go back out into the world. And most importantly, I live for the day when I can hold the hands of those I love.
We've got more after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Here's Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times.
I think one thing that has struck us all about this pandemic is just how quiet it is. You think of a disaster of this magnitude like it's some sort of action movie, and this has been just largely silent. Yet you know that people are living lives in their houses, and those who are by themselves have no contact with anyone and don't have anyone to hug or touch. And we wanted to find out what was happening and give voice to all of these people, whether they are suffering in solitude or enjoying the solitude or not having their lives change that much from before. We just had a sense that there's a lot going on and a lot of sort of inner noise being made in these lives that we wanted to find out about. And the stuff that came in, even the stuff that's painful, just sort of made us so appreciative of people's struggles and what they treasure. It was just a really rich experience in seeing these, you know, more than 2,000 stories come in from people all around the world, giving voice to their struggles and their hopes and their expectations for how this is all going to end.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Caitlin O'Keefe. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Iris Adler is our executive producer. We're edited by Catherine Brewer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. The stories you heard today were edited by Jessica Bennett, Mia Lee, Anya Stremian, and Daniel Jones at The New York Times. Special thanks to them. Thanks also to all of the people who contributed a story to this episode. You can find a full list of contributors at wbur.org/modernlove. And you can read all of the stories that are part of the Alone in a Pandemic project at nytimes.com/modernlove. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Additional thanks to Julia Simon at The New York Times and Paul Kahlo at WBUR. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Hang in there. We'll see you next week.